Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here. Sometimes, though, I'll review something which is not a science fiction book or is not a book or is not a science fiction book or anything at all. So that's what I'm doing this time out. It's not so much a book, it's a comic, it's not science fiction, it's fantasy, but I thought people might be interested to see what I have to say about this one. So years and years ago, I tried reading a novel by an author who has won many Hugo Awards and Nebula Awards called Neil Gaiman. And I thought, oh, let's check this out. Didn't really manage to get into American Gods at all. Stopped after a few chapters thinking, this just isn't my kind of thing. This is not really what I want. And then a few years ago, I tried reading it again, this time for the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. Again, it had come up so many times. I think it was a book which had won the Hugo and Nebula Award. I'm not sure. So I was like, right, I'm really going to get through it this time. It's part of my Hugula's challenge to myself. And I started and again got maybe about halfway through it this time. And I was just like, this is just not the kind of thing for me. It was at the time, a lot of people told me, hey, if you really like The Sandman, this is kind of a continuation or this is like more of The Sandman. So people who've read The Sandman and want some more of the same similar kind of thing from Neil Gaiman, this is where they could get it. And people who like The Sandman could kind of do that. And I think a few people mentioned that to me. I think Jesse from SFF Audio and Tamahomi or something, they mentioned that kind of thing. And this could have been, like, if I'd have read The Sandman, I could have got more into American Gods. However, kind of after reading American Gods and people say, oh, no, this is like The Sandman, but kind of almost put me off The Sandman. But what I did, I downloaded a few issues of The Sandman and started reading it. This was about a year ago. Probably at the beginning of this year. I'm not entirely sure. 7 or 8 months ago, I'm not sure. But I downloaded a few issues. And that was good. And then I was like, oh, this could be something I could read more of. And so I downloaded a few. And then I realized, hey, if I carry on, this is going to get quite expensive quite quickly. So I managed to find a version which wasn't which I didn't have to pay for. And so I carried on and carried on reading. And it took a while to get going. Like the first few issues, it's kind of broken down. If I go across here onto Wikipedia, there's kind of lots of different collections, like Preludes and Nocturnes, Sandman issue 1 to 8. Yeah, what is it? Goes all the way up to issue 75. So there's 75 of these to get through. So this is a massive amount of work. I can't really go into a lot of detail as I would normally do in a story, because this is like trying to review, I don't know, like the whole Bible or a whole series of fantasy books all in one. There are just loads of characters, loads of series, loads of individual stories, lots of storylines that go through. Or it's like, I was going to say it's like removing a series of movies, but I think it's even more than that. Maybe like reviewing all of 7 seasons of a TV show and trying to explain what happens in all of them. So maybe it's a bit too big to talk about in that way. But The Sandman, yeah, here we go, The Sandman. And so I started it off, Preludes and Nocturnes, Sandman 1 to 8. And it's pretty weird to actually talk about something which I finished reading maybe about a month ago, I guess. And in August, I guess sometime in August, I finished this off on a work trip in August, and thinking, well, it's about a month ago. But then I was thinking, well, how long ago, again, was it since I read the first issue? So I just went back today, because I knew I was going to be recording this podcast today. So I went back and I read through the first issue of Sandman again, issue number one, and it's terrible. It's just awful. And I was like, how did I ever read this and carry on? But I guess I probably did read it and then was just like, well, I guess I've got the next few issues to go. And so I did it. But like, I look back and the art is just awful. In fact, I do remember looking at this first page, wake up, sir, here we are. And back in 1916, and the character designs are just terrible. And there's these characters that turn up and it's just messy and everything's all over the place. And I was just like, this is really amazing that people read this first issue and was like, oh yeah, I really got to read another 75 of these. But actually, after the first few issues, I do remember it starting to pick up and get good once the characters are kind of settled in. Because the Sandman doesn't really come into this first story very much. It's talking about these people who capture the Sandman and things, and he escapes 75 years later. So 75 years goes by in this first issue, and people grow old, and then he comes out and, you know, he frees himself. And then, is the vengeful presence and and goes against it. But then after once actually the Sandman turns up and you start meeting the characters that he in, you know, like he starts meeting characters and we start, you know, following other characters and having other people's stories, that's suddenly where it comes much more alive, because the Sandman as a character at the start, not that interesting, like not very, I mean, the story's kind of okay, but what really comes to life is all the people around the Sandman who are kind of affected by it. The Sandman himself, for a lot of this, is just sort of, it's more of a presence, like he turns up in other people's stories and does stuff. And so when I actually made a list of like some of my favorite things, like some of my favorite storylines or favorite issues that happen here, I realized that at the start, there's just nothing. Like it takes about, noticed to put a thing here, Corinthian on the loose. So I think that's probably the doll's house. So yeah, actually it's probably only after the first 8 issues, Preludes and Nocturnes go by. Don't really remember anything about that at all. Maybe it's because I read it so long ago. But then in the doll's house, there's actually quite a few things, like a few characters in there which are, you know, are really interesting. and there's the one of my favorite sections where is the Corinthian turns up at a convention of serial killers, and Morpheus the Sandman turns up there as well and sorts that kind of situation out. And you start realizing, oh, okay, what I actually like about it is that, like, these other kind of powerless figures who exist in the world and dream, Morpheus, the Sandman, lots of different names for this one person, Dream of the Endless, this kind of it's almost impossible to do this because there's so much like theology and mythology in this book, which is some of it's like real mythology. I was going to say real mythology. Some of it's mythology from the real world. Other stuff is brought in and just invented by Neil Gaiman, but there's a lot of it there. So it's a bit difficult to always get everybody's name straight and things. But yeah, so what Morpheus, like a powerful being intersecting in the lives of less powerful beings, be they humans, be they angels, although angels are quite powerful, be they other like facets within the dreaming, within this the realm that Dream lives in, his kind of world that exists, like all of those all of those different characters that come into action, that's where it really starts to shine. And that's what I really picked up for me, going through like that second, I guess, volume. So, oh yeah, it says here, total of 10 trade paperbacks. So I guess that's where you can, do it here. I also noticed this as well. Vertigo began releasing a new edition of the Sandman books featuring the new coloring of the Absolute from the Absolute editions. I think I read the non-Absolute editions, but I'm not entirely sure. So what we have is this story of, I didn't really say, but the Sandman is the person, is the thing, is this entity, kind of a god which controls the dreams of people, but he doesn't really, it kind of all happens, but he's just one aspect of the force, power force thing that controls dreams. And he's got 6 brothers and sisters, where if I actually quickly now have a look at the Wikipedia page, list of characters in the Sandman comics, so you've got these other people, and they all begin funnily enough with D. So you've got Destiny, Death, Dream, Destruction, Despair, Desire, and Delirium. These don't always come, these kind of come in as those things come in, you realize, oh, it's part of something bigger, and each of those have got their own storylines going on that you don't always pick up on. And so this whole thing over 75 issues becomes this massive like epic tale of the way that the dream aspect called Morpheus intersects with the lives of other people, and how those things and other gods and other figures from mythology and theology, and then as you see his personality develop and what he's like, you know, he kind of softens over time, somewhere manages to get a slight sense of humor, kind of, and then as those things come back to bite him, what happens all the way through to the end. So you've got this big epic cycle with a big fun tragic ending and lots of those mythology and themes going on there as well. So it's like a massive work, And yeah, so my favorite part is where Dream isn't always the, I mean, he is sometimes the main character, but it was when he was the main character at the start, I didn't like him at all. And as I said, I just read back through the first issue, still don't like him at the start. But when you actually get to know the character of Dream, of Morpheus, through his interaction with other people, so then when you actually get through to the end section of the entire series, the kindly ones, where it suddenly everything goes down and you realize, oh, okay, now you understand how important this character is in all these people's lives, and you actually start caring about him and what he does. And I think that's where this character really comes into his own all the way through to the end, you know. But those, again, say the kindly ones is quite a big collection, quite a big volume at the end. What is it, 57 to 69? So that's a big chunk of the story happens at the end. Again, it's just too much to talk about anything in depth, but it's from some of my favourite sections here, which is, yeah, I quite like the Corinthian on the loose at a convention of serial killers. That whole storyline is good. Then we get this collection of short stories, and two of these were really, really impressive. One of them is Calliope, who is a muse. Muse, and the muse is imprisoned, and then, you know, this author, by imprisoning this muse, managed to tell some amazing stories, and everyone loves the stories, and he gets lots of big success, and that was a really great story. The other one was Midsummer Night's Dream, which was absolutely fantastic. It was one of those kind of things where you read something and you go, this is just amazing. Everybody should find out about this issue, this story, because it's like every issue, there's like four or five issues in a row, which are just short stories, which kind of feature, again, Morpheus as a side character who just comes up, shows up in a few panels or a few pages and does something. And Midsummer Night's Dream, I was reading it and I was like, okay, so Morpheus commissioned Shakespeare to write a play and then got the characters, like get all the players together to perform the play for the first time, Midsummer Night's Dream. So it's the opening of night, but it's not in a theatre. They're just contracted to do, like, to present the play, and Shakespeare is in, no, I think Shakespeare's son's in the play, whatever, so they're going to present this play, Shakespeare doesn't know that when he presents this play just in a field beside a road, that the people who are going to turn up to it are actually the characters from the fairy characters, the people from the land of Fae, and they all come in there, and there's Oberon, is it Titania? Titania, I can't even remember how to pronounce it. Anyway, so all of these characters actually turn up and watch it. And like I say, it's one of those things where I was just going, this is just amazing. Like, I didn't even know, like, it's, I mean, of course you kind of see this kind of thing in movies where you get like in a movie, they're making a movie, and you're like, oh, that's clever. There's a movie with a movie being made in it. But already, Midsummer Night's Dream is a play with a play in it. But then, if you're actually watching the telling of a story of the play, anyway, I just wanted to say there's lots of different layers there, and it is one of those things where you just go, oh, this. And then, of course, when I actually looked it up, now I'm looking it up, it's like, yes, this issue won the World Fantasy Award, and it was like the best-selling, it was on the bestsellers list and all of this kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, okay, that kind of makes sense. So it's not just me. Oh, what does it say? It received a World Fantasy Award for short fiction in 1991. So it's not just me who recognizes that this is just genius. But it was one of those things where I was just reading it, just going, this is just incredible. And I kind of was like, oh, this is what people are always talking about with me when they're saying about Neil Gaiman. And like, he's a genius, and his stories are just amazing. This was the first glimpse of it that I had. And when I was reading American Gods, there was none of that. There was nothing clever in American Gods that I could see at all. It just felt like somebody trying to be clever. It's like, oh, and there's a guy called Loki, and there's a guy called Mr. Wednesday. And I'm like, okay, so it's Loki and Odin. Like, what's clever here? But he can't be that clever. I mean, the writing, it can't be that cute in comics, because it's there. You can't just, like, the characters are there and they have to be recognizable. And they are recognizable. And it's like, let's say it's epic when you get here. So back to my notes. What else did I enjoy? Oh, so then we go on, and there's a whole volume Season of Mists, which is a great thing about who gets to run hell. And I really enjoyed that kind of that section. And then there's another collection of short stories that I remember. And but there was this one which actually I didn't get or something like that. I think I bought some of these as this was another section that I bought, and I was you know buying the issues because they were individual issues. And I was like, oh, I'll just buy this one, whatever. And I just missed Song of Orpheus, and I read it out of order. And then later on in this series, there's like this really big important moment in the next. In this next series, which is called Brief Lives, on the next volume, Brief Lives, where Delirium and Dream, they go to find Destruction, who is the missing brother of Delirium and Dream and Death and all of the Destiny and all those people. The missing brother, they go to find him, and they go to one place, and it's like, I'm going to go in here into this house and talk to someone, and that person's going to do it. And then at the end of that, he goes back into the house, he's like, well, I've got a job to do here. And I was like, I don't understand what's going on. I was like, I've missed something. I must have missed an issue. And I realized, yeah, I've missed Songs of Orpheus. And then I read it and I was like, oh, shit, this is a big story. Even though it was in one of those short collections or one of these volumes, which are kind of a collection of different short stories, which even in the introductions to some of them or the author's notes at the back of the issues of some of them that I was reading. Yeah, so I guess I was reading the original printing or scans of the original printing. He was like, oh, yeah, well, I had these six or seven short stories and they were just going to be scattered throughout. But I thought, well, actually, let's collect them together into a volume and it's going to be a series. And I realized I just missed that one. It was like a massive, massive event. And I'm glad that I didn't, that I managed to catch it, even though that section, which could have been a bit more meaningful, but you really, really needed to know that before you get to some of the next sections. Anyway, World's End, I really enjoyed this, some of these short stories in World's End, and it's a bit more of a structured series of stories. There's actually like a good framing device. People get together in a bar called the World's End, which is kind of at the World's End, but outside of time, and lots of people come together, and they tell each other stories. A lot of those stories are... actually, all of them are really good. And I think that's where Neil Gaiman... So a lot of this stuff is again, I think his cleverest writing comes out where he's like away from the main storyline in these shorter story collections. And then we get onto the Kindly Ones, which is the big like epic tragic end to the whole story. And I really like that some of the minor characters suddenly become heroes. They've been like hanging around all the time, and I'm like, well, these are cute characters. And then suddenly they're like, oh right, okay, these guys are actually pretty important. They're not just people who hang around. And then there's the end, the wake, which is called the wake. Even though it's called the wake, it doesn't give away too much to call it the wake. And it's a good wrap up to the series. And then after it, there's another few short stories kind of to wrap up the end of the end. So even after the end, where everyone has their final say, and we get to find out what happened to all the characters at the end, like we find out who's died and who's not died, and who is immortal or who's been brought back to life or who has been immortal and they don't want to die or now they want to die, maybe they do want to die. And we get a few little stories that kind of wrap it up after that as well. And there are some other stuff in the Sandman series, but I just thought I'd stop at 75 because once you go, oh, and I'll read this collection that was printed later, you know, that's not kind of the part of the original run, the original like conception or the original idea that went all the way through this kind of thing. But it is amazing to see this kind of evolving story, which, of course, lots of comic people have this all the time, but I've never really read a comic series this long before, which is set over this amount of time of publication, and to see all the different, all the different styles of art and the characters and how they evolve over time. It was really impressive. And it was only actually then when I went there, actually, I kind of had a glimpse of this in the first section. It's like, okay, this thing. And then someone is in Arkham Asylum. And I was like, oh, wait, isn't that for Batman? And I was like, oh, it's DC. Oh, this is DC Comics. Oh, right. Okay. And there was a few times when I had that and I was like, oh, okay, this is happening in a wider world. And there were some characters who were there and who were like, especially this character called Matthew. And I was really intrigued with Matthew, who was a raven. And he was always going, well, before I was a raven, I was a man, wasn't I? But who was I? And it's like, yeah. And over the course of like these 75 issues, you realize, oh, Raven used to be someone, but I don't know who that person is. And there was a real mystery behind it. But apparently he's in the dreaming because he was a real man who was having a dream. Or he was in the dreaming, and then his body died, I think, like that. And it's never quite explained. And it's like, well, what happens to him after? But there's been previous ravens to him, but what happened to them? And what's going to happen after he does his job? Or what is his job? And there's this whole mystery going on with Matthew the Raven. And I was really interested in that. And of course, now, just today, when I opened up lots of Wikipedia pages, and I was like, well, who is this person? Turns out a DC comic character at around about the same time in the DC continuity was in a coma and died, and then it was like, oh, so that's Matthew. But I would have, there's just no way to get any of these references to the wider DC universe without knowing where these characters, like, without also following along with the continuity in the, like, in like 1987 or 1988 or whenever this series started way back in the day. And but I didn't pick up in any of those references, but it kind of gave the world a much richer feeling than it just being, oh, this is a play on a Shakespeare character. Oh, this is Cain and Abel from the Bible, and this is a person from Greek mythology, and this is this real character from history, and yeah, and here's Augustus Caesar, and here's Marco Polo. These are all characters and things. And a lot of those I kind of recognize, but it kind of feels like easy to put those references, even though it isn't easy, of course, but to put those kind of references into a book, you kind of think, okay, well, I get that reference because it doesn't feel like those characters come to life, because it's like, oh, well, you're just borrowing that from another place. But I think the thing that felt really interesting to me is that this stuff in the DC, the crossover from the other DC comics at the time, it only seemed to be there at the beginning, but actually says on Wikipedia that over time it became its own kind of universe. It had its own rules. It didn't have to have crossover characters, even though I understood that some of them were kind of superheroes. I wasn't quite sure of some of them. But yeah, you got these characters, and there's no way I could know about it, but they're not from old mythology. They're from new kind of comic book mythology. Anyway, I can't really formulate my thoughts on this, but it feels richer when there's no way that I could have known it, in a way. Even though I could have known it, but it's like it's so minor. Or like, but who is Matthew? It's kind of more. It was more important to me who Matthew was than who this other character was, who turns out to be someone from the Bible or someone from Greek mythology or something like that, because he is a nobody. Because he was in. It was just a DC comic person, and it doesn't really matter about that anyway. I'm just saying the source of mystery there felt like a real mystery, because who could it have been? Like, who would it have been? And I think that's what I get with some of these other characters, which seem to be created just for this series, just for Sandman, just for this thing, like Hobbs or Hob. Actually, let me look up his real name here. I made a note of it before. Yeah, Robert Hob Gadling. And who is the character that they just go, oh, he just says, I'm never going to die. He's just like a joker. He's like, yep, I'm not going to die because I refuse. I will, when death comes to me, I will refuse to die. And Dream is watching this and says, hey, Death, tell you what, just never visit this guy. So he'll never die. And Death is like, okay. And so Hob just keeps living and meets up with Death once every 100 years. He's like, well, I'll meet you back here in 100 years. Okay. And I'll meet you back here in another 100 years. Yep, okay. And it's always fun to see, like, when we go back in history and actually see some of these stories back in history, it's fun to see this guy pop up. And one of my favorite moments in this whole series is, like, the last issue, or the second to last issue, where Hob Gadling is now in the 20th century, and he goes along to a Ren fair in America, and he was born in medieval times and lived all the way through. And he's just going, oh, this place is awful. Like, it's nothing like the medieval times was. And I was like, I have had this exact same experience. Not that I've lived for 800 years and then visited a Ren fair in America, but I am British. And when I was in America a few years ago, maybe I've told this story on the podcast before, I'm not quite sure, but I was over in Kansas City. And we went over to Kansas, and there was a Ren fair, and we went there because I'm a juggler, and there were some jugglers performing there, and we could all just go in. Oh, it was all great. Go in and watch the fun stuff. And I was walking around, and I was like, I didn't think it was horrible. I thought it was just, you know, farcically dumb, but actually quite fun. It's just like a fair, yeah, sure, everyone's dressing up, and some people were putting on accents, but they had the, you know, the horse, I was going to say horse fighting, not horse fighting, what do you call it, jousting, and all that kind of stuff. Great, no problem at all about any of that. But then I was there, and there was another British guy there who was also just traveling around America, had been to the same festival, he was a juggler, and he was British as well. And so we were there with a group of Americans, and they're like, oh, this must feel like home for you guys. This is really British. And we both just burst out laughing. And I said, no, this is the most American thing I've ever done. The most American thing I've ever done, because it's Americans pretending that history exists, even though there's loads of history in America. They're like, no, we don't need all that history in America. We're going to put on European history, and we're going to play it being European history, because, you know, sort of like American history, that's I guess they get the Civil War reenactors and things like that, but they're not interested in history. They're just interested in white person, like transplanting white person's history to America, which is super American. But then it's not actually real history at all, because it's not medieval, because, and this is what Hobby is talking about in this comic. He's saying this is nothing like medieval Britain, because it's nothing to do with medieval Europe or medieval times. It's to do with like what the Victorians reconstructed the medieval times to be in their fiction, with all their King Arthur kind of legends and all their paintings that they have, which are amazing. You know, they kind of just go, oh, King Arthur and this and that. And then you get like the 1920s, 1930s cinema version of those same stories, which are then updated into sort of like the late 20th century movie versions of those stories, which is then iterated through American popular culture and the way that people dress up in those kind of things back. And then it kind of came through in like the 1970s, where people were all doing, you know, the Ren Fair stuff. And then that's filtered through another generation of people who have grown up going to Ren Fairs. And then what they think of as European history is gone through like these like six or seven different filters to get to what they actually think, you know, Renaissance or Ren Fair kind of, what are they representing? I don't know. They're representing what they grew up with going to Ren Fairs, which is, you know, all of those different steps back to what actual real history could be. Again, I've got no problem with that happening, but it's like, it's just the most American thing is to not be celebrating history, but to be celebrating like the popular culture version of the movie culture version of the literature and painting version of the, you know, like the theatrical version of what, anyway, going all the way back there. So I realized that Neil Gaiman has obviously been to a Ren Fair in America and just looked around and gone, oh, and then decided to put those views into Rob, like Hob Gadling. And I always realized that that character is kind of probably the most, I'm not sure if it's the most Neil Gaiman-y kind of character, but it's like, oh, I'm a British guy who has gone through this kind of stuff and I'm growing up and sorting out these issues. So, yeah, Hob Gadling. Who else did I like? Actually, pretty much most of the people who are in The Dreaming, which I realize a lot of them aren't real characters, or they're characters who just exist as facets of the dream in The Dreaming, which is a bit weird. But you've got Lucian, who's like the bookkeeper, and Matthew the Raven, I mentioned him as well, and Mervin the pumpkin head guy, which is just, they could just kind of, you know, they're just kind of keeping things running in there. I mentioned before about the Corinthian, who is a really interesting, is he a hero or is he not a hero, or like what is the Corinthian? Like, he starts out as bad and then there's like a, like, is there another version of him? I'm not entirely sure, but I really liked that character too. And what else? Oh yeah, the gatekeepers of the Dreaming, which is the Griffin and the Hippogriff and the, oh, I can't remember what the third one was. Anyway, there's these three mythical beings and they're there and they always, like, everyone who comes in, they have like a really fun little quirky conversation. It's like, oh, can you come in? Oh, don't walk off the light, or don't stray away from the path. You just go straight there. People do this and they get those kind of things. And there's a few other characters which I really enjoyed, like some of the human characters as well, as you go through, and the gods, and there's just loads of really good stuff. I can't go through everything. And I just made a note here of what I didn't like about Sandman, which is like some of the changes in the art style. Now, of course, when you've got 75 issues and it runs over, what, 7 or 8, 9, 10 years or something, it's not always going to be the same, even though it's the same author, it's often different people doing the artwork, the penciling and the inking and all these other kinds of stuff, and the text or the lettering or whatever the terms are in comics. I think, yeah, it's lettering, isn't it? So those things, those jobs were kind of passed around different things, different, I was going to say artists. Yeah, I guess all artists. So different artists were doing different things. And like I say, I look back on that first issue and the art is just awful, but then it kind of settles down into an art style. Like after like that first volume, kind of settles down into an art style that I like for like the next half of it. And then I realized, oh, some of these individual short stories obviously got different different artists. But then part of the way through, the art style just changed so much, and some of it was really good, really good art. The characters were amazing, you know, just the way it was all colored and the art style I really enjoyed. And then suddenly the next issue would be just awful, and I'm like, I don't like. If it was just like this art or slightly better all the way through, it wouldn't be so bad, but there was a contrast between. And then at one point it suddenly goes, right, now we're going to be telling this big epic story, and the cartoon style just goes, oh, and it looks now looks like a really cartoony style, looks kind of too modern for what we're talking about now. It's kind of been a bit more kind of classical. I mean, I don't even know how to say classical art, but like I guess the kind of pre-Raphaelite stuff where everyone is kind of like when you're doing stories with fairies and gods and stuff, it has to have this it feels like it should have this look to it, and it kind of gives it this like, okay, this is person looks like a Greek sculpture version of that person, and then it's rendered in art and you're like, okay, this is good, I'm liking this. And I really liked the fact that it's like the people looked like humans all the time. Like the women's breasts weren't massive. Was it last summer? I on Comixology, they had this, okay, Comixology, free, lots of free comics this summer. And I read through loads of these comics, and it was just amazing. Like, do any of these, like, they really, really detailed anatomy of men, and then women is like, okay, really detailed, but just wrong. Like, women's boobs just don't look like that. They're just, like, why are these, anyway, what I really liked about The Sandman is that I kind of got away from, like the over fascination with female breasts and buttocks and things, which I just don't like in my fiction. I got away from all of that. I always hate it and stuff. I quite like watching some car videos sometimes, and be like, yay, and now cars are driving around, and then they'll just say, and now some pictures of women's breasts and boobs, and they're washing cars, and now back to the cars. And I'm like, why did we have to have that car wash scene in here? Stop putting porn in my car porn. I just want the car porn. I just want to see people driving stupidly, or these action movies, or surfing. And I'm like, yay, surfing. And it's like, and now lots of shots of women on the beach sunbathing with just, let's just literally close-ups of bottoms for a few seconds. And now let's get back to the surfing. I'm like, I just want to see people surfing. Anyway, it's almost impossible for me to concentrate on the stories and characters in comics when that happens. None of that was, it was, all of that was missing. But in some ways, like, if it was just like that all the way through, I could kind of file it away and just like, okay, I don't want it. But when it suddenly just showed up a little bit here, I'm like, no, this is not art. And sometimes the characters were so badly drawn, I was like, I don't recognize this person from it. Is they're like, oh, and now we look at this one. I'm like, who is this person? And it's like, I can't remember. And because a lot of the time, because we switch around different viewpoints so often, you often have to just pick up and just remember what happened, you know, 20 issues ago. And it's like, oh, okay, we're back to this character. Oh, it's Barbie again, right? Got this. And sometimes we'll just switch and it'd be like a different art style. And I have to like relearn, oh, this character. And I go back to the previous issue. I was like, oh, that was good. Blonde hair. And she's right. Okay, now I can work out. So it was really bad. I could tell often that it was a different artist in the most, like, there's lots of different artists all the way through the first half, but it got to the second half of the run and it was switching, and it wasn't that I could just tell the art was changing, but then it got in the way because then I couldn't tell who was who in the book. And it's, and I don't mind it so much when they're kind of more of the mythical characters, like when it's Morpheus or the Sandman himself. I don't mind that he kind of changes because he's a dream figure and gods can change around. But when they're human figures, like and then in the previous issue, it kind of ends on a cliffhanger, and then we pick up in the next issue and there's the same group of humans, but now I can't tell who the humans are. It's like the humans shouldn't be changing that much. They're not dream characters or not. So and then there was this one character who turned up and I was like, wow, that woman is drawn so badly, or this person is drawn so badly, I'm not quite sure if they're meant to be, is it meant to be a woman, or is it meant to be a man, or is it a man in drag? And it turns out, oh, this is actually like a pre-op transsexual. And I was like, okay, so maybe that's good art style, that I could tell that I wasn't meant to be able to tell if it was a male or female, but that's not a good sign where I'm actually going, like, it could have been really obvious, but because there was lots of other bad art around about the same time, I was like, oh, that's not so good. So I think the art was one of the things which kind of put me off on this. So if you actually pick up issue number one and start reading and go, oh, this, I can't do this, it's so confusing, don't worry, it gets a lot better. And then it gets worse, but then it ends up good again. But there are some big switches there. I'm not going to name all the artists because there's no way I can look it up. There's no way I can keep track of this. 75 different issues. What else? Yeah, something I didn't like. But there wasn't a lot of things that I didn't like because it's quite. There was a few issues that I didn't like. Some of those shorter stories. There was this one which was like about Baghdad, and there was it was like a 1001 nights kind of thing that Baghdad was going to be. There was going to stories be told about it or something like that. And I must admit, I just kind of started flicking through the pages of that because it was like lots and lots of text, like solid text and stuff. And when you're actually into that kind of, like when you're into the kind of the flow of all these different comics, you get to one and it's such a different style of art and such a different style of storytelling that I was just like, I can't really focus on this. And there was a few which were a bit like that. But some of those which totally changed around and totally switched the story, it was amazing. There was this one, I can't remember what it was, but it was this, and it was actually, it started off being like, this doesn't feel at all like a Sandman comic. It was about a guy, a father and a son in I'm guessing somewhere in South Africa, who go off and they're like, right, we're going to walk out into the desert and I'm going to tell you the story, and no, you're never going to tell this story at all until it's the time for you to tell your son this story. That's the next time that you'll ever tell this story. And they go and do this, and the story is actually quite important. But that started off, I was like, oh, I can't see where this is going at all. And then it ended up really good, whereas some of the short stories, I started them, I was like, oh, I can't see where this is going to end up. And I got to the end of it, I was like, well, I guess I read that. Didn't get much from it. But what else? Oh yeah, and what I also really like is as I quite like the lettering, which I mentioned before. The lettering is a thing that is done. A lot of the characters just talk in what would I say? They've just got normal text, but it's like the capital text. And what I really liked, unlike The Watchmen, which I read all the way through, and I really didn't like it because there was lots of times where the words were just almost seemingly randomly kind of put into a bold text. And when you put it into a bold text, it suddenly feels like people are shouting or really emphasizing different words as they go through. And I'm like, why are all these words? Now, this does happen a little bit, but it's like way more subtle, way, way, way more subtle. I'm not quite sure if it's just a thing. And then when Morpheus comes out himself, his writing is just in this this kind of white text on a black background with this kind of fuzziness around it, which is really good. And then the other D people, like Death and Delirium, they have all their own writing styles. And there's this one character who's only got half a face. I'm not really quite sure who she is or where she comes. I can't remember. But her writing is really good. Oh, and Delirium as herself is great too, because Delirium is all. Is all like la 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 la, and there's butterflies flying around the text, and it's all in multicolored, and the letters go big and small and big and small. It's just fantastic. So that really puts across a huge amount of just different character stuff, which is, it's kind of almost impossible to do it could be possible to do it in a novel, but it's the stuff that you can do inside the novel, I think we talked about the same thing when we were talking about Saga as well, with the lettering in the different languages, the different colours, and that happens a little bit here as well. But I just really enjoyed it. Like it's really expressive, and you can kind of pick up which characters are talking by. Oh, this character is actually this person, by the way that the lettering is done sometimes, and the style of it. So what else am I going to say? I've kind of run out of my notes. I've got to the end of my notes, and I would like to say, yeah, it's really good. To bring it back to American Gods, it really just shows that I think Neil Gaiman really... this being the only thing I've read by Neil Gaiman. Oh, no, actually, to be honest, I have actually read a few of his short stories and really enjoyed them. So I think the thing is, when it's come to these short stories, like I say, these like standalone issues in here, it's really good. And when I've read his short stories, also short stories, really good. And then when he goes over this epic scale of, right, okay, 75 issues, loads of different stories, loads of different characters, things coming back in and things referencing stuff that's happened so far ahead, loads of things, which, of course, is is which would be in the scripts, but like lots of other people contributing it to the art and the characters, and kind of working in a world which I like, with all these different characters coming in, which I kind of like. When it comes in, it's like, okay, this is the Sandman. The Sandman is the person who brings in dreams, and it's not trying to be cute or clever about it. It's like, oh, gods really exist, but people don't know the gods really exist, but they do really exist. Like in American Gods, like it just didn't feel convincing or clever at all. Whereas this feel like a, you know, Sandman does really feel like a work of genius. And so over that length, in a novel, like to be able to tell a coherent novel from start to finish, which is trying to be epic in scale, trying to be like mythological and theological and all those different kind of things about like, oh, gods and stuff. Like a novel is a very difficult length to do that kind of thing. You either have to do it in like a short story where it's like human-sized characters or smaller characters interacting with bigger things, and you just concentrate on the small story, or you have to have like an epic tale, literally epic, like going back, like biblical. You know, the only reason why the Bible is so important and fascinating and can kind of create all the myths and all the myths spring from it, is that it's so big and kind of contradictory, and there's so much development. Like there was this one idea, and then somebody else was like, I will now progress that idea. And then someone else says, I will now progress that idea. The way that it's doing is like bring up these little mysteries and bring up these little things and then try to explain them and then build a story on that. And then, oh, there's this minor thing in this thing. Oh, and then build onto that and trying to explain it. And you kind of build up on all of these different things going over and over and over again. And you can kind of create a very vibrant world where the mythical characters, they might just be archetypes, they might be stereotypes, whatever. But they each have an importance to it, which you have to have the time to develop that and the space to develop that to come up with something epic. And you can't just go, this is a story about gods, and therefore it's going to be epic because there's going to be a battle between gods. It's like, nah, it doesn't work that way. It kind of brings me back to what I said. The only time that the reason that I actually started caring about what was happening to Dream was because, oh, I've actually spent a lot of time with this character, and I realize how he interacts with people, and if this character dies, what will happen, you know, to all of these people that rely on him? What happens to the people in the dreaming? But when it does, you know, like if he dies or if he doesn't get through, and it doesn't matter, and before then he was so powerful that it was like, oh, there's nothing bad going to happen to it. But it does start with him being locked up for a lot of times, so you do know that bad things could happen, and there are kind of things that come up where you just go, oh no, this is important, that is important, so yeah, there could be important stuff later, and it does come together very well. But yeah, it's the epic style. You have to have room for an epic to grow. An epic can't just be authored. It has to exist and then grow over time. And you can kind of see that as well. I didn't read many of them, but sometimes I get to the end of a comic and there'll be like, yeah, notes from the author, letters from people. I wouldn't read it so much, but there'd be a few little things that I'd pick up on there going, oh yes, well, I didn't expect it to go in this direction, but this character is here and this character's there. What else? Oh, yeah, and the DC Universe stuff passed me by when I was reading it, but... I mentioned all that before. But yeah, I actually... That didn't get in my way. That this was set in a wider world only made it richer, unlike some other comics where I read it, and it's like this person turns up, and I'm like, who's this? And I was like, oh, no, this person's really important. I was like, why are they important? It's like, oh, they are. And then they disappear again. I was like, well, where was that person there? Again, I've never actually got into any of these comic series, but like the whole continuity, it creates... I was going to say, this uses mythology in a way which creates its own mythology rather than being a slave to a mythology, from the outside looking in, to other comic book stuff, it seems like, yeah, often the later stuff is a slave to the mythology, whereas this one kind of makes its own mythology, which is interesting. And I think that's probably why I like Saga a lot, and maybe Watchmen more than other comics, partly because they're just really, really good. And otherwise, it's because, yes, there's kind of a break from previous comic tradition, especially with the Watchmen. It was very much going, okay, this is going to be set in a world where superheroes don't exist and can't exist. Oh, no, they do exist, but they're not really super. Anyway, difficult to explain. Not going to get into the Watchmen again. So overall, I mean, I would give this a rating, but it's almost impossible to rate it because some of the issues, I was like, oh, that was really bad. And at the start, I was like, oh, this is not very good at all. But by the end, I really did appreciate it. And it was one of those things where, like, as it got further and further on, like, the pace that I was reading, it just picked up and picked up and picked up. And, so then I got to the end, I was like, oh, that's very good. So I almost don't want to give it a rating because it's, like, too big to give a rating. Like, it's like going, I will give a rating to a whole genre of movies. Yes. action movies are 5-star movies. Like, no, but there's some bad movies and it's good. But I guess it is one complete work, so I should probably give it a high rating. Probably in the same kind of region as I would with Watchmen, even though Watchmen was kind of like more, I was going to say more restrained, but it was more restricted in its scope, and I enjoyed that. Whereas this one is, it's just almost completely unrestricted, and I enjoyed that, like, just as much in a way. So, I give it 4 stars or something for overall as a reading. It's probably more than that, probably 4.5 stars. It's not a 5-star because there are things about it, but part of that is just like what I like about comics. And I think reading Saga is kind of like where it is. Okay, there is one writer and there was one artist, and everything so far has been from one author and one artist, and there's kind of a more of a unified vision of what the world is like and the characters. Like, I like the characters more when I turn the page. I'm not confused about who I'm looking at. And I think comics as a genre and this series has got an art problem. Like, again, I kind of wish that they'd go, okay, that first story, that like first issue, why don't we just break that first issue down into like three issues, make the art a bit bigger, make it all better, get someone else to redraw it. It's like the same issue, same story, the same author's notes or whatever, but just spread it out a bit and then let us build up to this a bit better. Why is it all crammed in there? And I do think this could be something which, like, just in that first volume, just redo the first volume again. Same text, same storyline, same characters doing the same things, but just kind of, like, do the art better, and it'll just be a way better way into it, like a way more, like a way easier way into the whole story, volume, series, character, issues, what would you even call it? It's this whole, if I read comics more, I could probably get to series. Comic book series written by Neil Gaiman, published by DC Comics imprint Vertigo. So yeah, from 1989 to 1996. I tell you something, what I also liked about this is so 1980s and so 1990s. It is quite remarkable when people turn it around. I was like, oh, okay, you can kind of see this fitting in totally with all of the, like, the movies and like the gothy kind of and grungy kind of stuff that was going on at the time. I was like, oh wow, this is fantastic. So yeah, it's fun to see the fashions change as it goes through from, like, okay, this is definitely 80s until like near the end I was like, this is very, very 90s as it goes through. So yeah, look at this, one of the first few graphic novels to ever be on the New York Times bestseller list, along with Mouse, Watchmen, and The Dark Knight Returns. Maybe I should get to The Dark Knight Returns. That's the other of the big comic series that people always talk about, and Mouse as well, I guess. But when it comes to superhero comics, Watchmen and The Dark Knight, Dark Knight Returns? Dark Knight? Whatever. Rises? No, maybe I'm getting confused with movies now. Anyway, The Dark Knight series. Whatever. So that's it from me with this topic. I'll go home tomorrow, and in a few days' time, Juliana and I will review 2 different books. We'll get to Anubis Gates by Tim Powers and Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson, 2 of the books that you got done. So we'll get those episodes out. Sorry about the sound quality in some of these recent episodes, just having problems with various things with my laptop. I dropped my laptop. The camera stopped working, which means that the photos that I take of me holding up books and stuff on the podcast network, I have to take with my iPhone now or something, on my iPad, looking at my phone, whatever, which way around it'll work, and I'm having a few issues, but whatever, we'll get them sorted out. So that's it from me. You can follow me on Twitter at Luke Burge. If you've got any comments about this, you can email me luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email that I get, especially if you ask me a question. You want to recommend books to me, you can do that over on Goodreads and the books I would like to see reviewed page, in the discussion forum, SFBRP listener groups. You can follow me and become my friends on Goodreads as well and follow along with what I'm reading. And follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge there. And that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.